Blog Talk Radio.
I'm bringing to the stage my man from Yonkers, New York,
DMX. That's what's up. I appreciate it. What I'm going to speak on is the thing that's on my mind the most. You know what I'm saying? The thing that we all got to deal with every day, but don't really know. The industry. The industry. Man, it's not the same. Doesn't have to do with talent. It's about playing the game. The industry. Real niggas is dying to get in. The industry, just to find they don't fit in. The industry ain't what it used to be. The industry's trying to control the way you MC. They want you to dress like this and talk like that. But I'm going to dress like this and talk with the bat. The industry, got your word meaning nothing. The industry, fuck what you heard because he's bluffing. The industry, money, bitches, hate, but I dare you to try to take a fucking thing off my plate. The industry like, wait, but in the streets we like, get him. 17 up in that thing. Catch him sleeping and hit him. The industry, if you ain't got a strong mind, the industry will break you down. It's a matter of time. The industry, vultures with nothing to feast on. See me? I'm getting my beast on. The industry, stay in the dirt, play in the dirt. Test the wrong one in the industry and you will get hurt. I'm not an industry artist. I'm an artist in the industry. So I do what the fuck I want because nobody can finish me. The industry, wanted, dead or alive, new artists to sell their souls in the way they survive. The industry don't give a fuck about you, but the industry couldn't make a dime without you. The industry, I'm sick of this industry shit. The industry playing them like a industry bitch. They tried to finish me quick, but I am long, so I stand strong. Fuck a beat. Listen to the words in the damn song. I only know how to speak the truth, you know what I'm saying? So I got a little short joint I'm going to hit you with, you know what I'm saying? And it basically reflects on my relationship with the industry. This is what it is. Often, my words fall on deaf ears. Motherfuckers be listening, but don't hear. Talking to a nigga, he be sitting right here. I be like, where you going? Nigga be like, yeah. Thank you.
March 13, 1962. Lyman Lemnitzer, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, presents a proposal to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara named Operation Northwoods. The document proposed staging terrorist attacks in and around Guantanamo Bay to provide a pretext for military intervention in Cuba. The plans included starting rumors about Cuba using clandestine radio, land friendly Cubans inside the base to stage attacks, starting riots at the main gate, blowing up ammunition inside the base, starting fires, sabotaging aircraft and ships on the base, bombing the base with mortar shells, sinking a ship outside the entrance, staging funerals for mock victims, staging a terror campaign in Miami, Florida and Washington, D.C., and finally, destroying a drone aircraft over Cuban waters. The passengers, federal agents in reality, would allegedly be college students on vacation. A plane at Eglin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as a duplicate of a registered civil aircraft belonging to a CIA front in Miami. The duplicate would be substituted for the real plane and loaded with the passengers. The real plane would be converted into a drone. The two planes would rendezvous south of Florida. The passenger-laden plane would land at Eglin Air Force Base to evacuate its passengers and return to its original status. The drone would pick up the scheduled flight plan and, over Cuban waters, transmit a mayday signal before being blown up by remote control. The plan is rejected by McNamara, and President John F. Kennedy removes Lemnitzer as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff months later. December 1st, 1984. a remote-controlled Boeing 720 takes off from Edwards Air Force Base and is crash-landed by NASA for fuel research. Before its destruction, the plane flew unmanned for a total of 16 hours and 22 minutes, including 10 takeoffs, 69 approaches, and 13 landings. August 1997. The cover of FEMA's Emergency Response to Terrorism depicts the World Trade Center in crosshairs. February 28, 1998. The Global Hawk, Raytheon's unmanned aircraft vehicle, completes its first flight over Edwards Air Force Base in California at an altitude of 32,000 feet, cruising altitude for a commercial jetliner. 1999. NORAD begins conducting exercises in which hijacked airliners are flown into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. June 2000. The Department of Justice releases a terrorism manual with the World Trade Center in crosshairs. September 2000. The Project for a New American Century, a neoconservative think tank whose members include Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush, and Paul Wolfowitz, releases their report entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses. In it, they declare that the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. October 24th, 2000. The Pentagon conducts the first of two training exercises called Mascow, which simulate a Boeing 757 crashing into the building. Charles Burlingame, an ex-Navy F-4 pilot who worked in the Pentagon for 17 years, participates in an earlier version of this exercise in 1989 before retiring to take a job at American Airlines, where, 12 years later, his Boeing 757 allegedly crashes into the Pentagon. April 2001. NORAD plans an exercise in which a plane is flown into the Pentagon but is rejected as too unrealistic. June 2001. The Department of Defense initiates new instructions for military intervention in the case of a hijacking. It states that for all non-immediate responses, the Department of Defense must get permission directly from the Secretary of Defense. Attorney General John Ashcroft begins flying on chartered jets for the remainder of his term due to a threat assessment by the FBI. July 4, 2001. Osama bin Laden, wanted by the United States since 1998, receives medical attention at the American Hospital in Dubai, where he is visited by a local chief of the CIA. July 24, 2001. Larry A. Silverstein, who already owned World Trade Center 7, signs a $3.2 billion, 99-year lease on the entire World Trade Center complex, 6 weeks before 9/11. Included in the lease is a $3.5 billion insurance policy specifically covering acts of terrorism. September 6, 2001. 3,150 put options are placed on United Airlines stock. A put option is a bet that a stock will fall. That day, put options were more than four times its daily average. Bomb-sniffing dogs are pulled from the World Trade Center, and security guards end 2 weeks of 12-hour shifts. September 7, 2001. 27,294 put options are placed on Boeing stock, more than five times its daily average. September 10, 2001. 4,516 put options are placed on American Airlines, almost 11 times its daily average. Newsweek reports that a number of top Pentagon brass canceled their flight plans for the next morning. San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown receives a phone call warning him not to fly the next morning. And in Pakistan, at a military hospital, all of the urologists are replaced by a special team in order to host their guest of honor, Osama bin Laden, who is carefully escorted inside to be watched carefully and looked after. September 11, 2001. The National Reconnaissance Office in Chantilly, Virginia, is preparing for an exercise in which a small corporate jet crashes into their building. NORAD is in the middle of a number of military exercises. The first, Vigilant Guardian, is described as an exercise that would pose an imaginary crisis to North American air defense outposts nationwide. The second, Northern Vigilance, moved fighter jets to Canada and Alaska to fight off an imaginary Russian fleet. Three F-16s from Washington, D.C.'s National Guard at Andrews Air Force Base, 15 miles from the Pentagon, are flown 180 nautical miles away for a training mission in North Carolina. This left 14 fighter jets to protect the contiguous United States.
All right, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise manifest. Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft? Oh, God, I don't know. That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
The first question I have is basically to get from you a sense of how you would rate the American media in their coverage of the events of the attack last September.
Well, let's see. Shamefully is a word that comes to mind.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
But overall, the American journalism was cowed and intimidated by this massive flag-sucking, this patriotic orgy. You know, if you criticize the president, it's unpatriotic and there's something wrong with you, you may be a terrorist.
So in that sense, Hunter S. Thompson, there's not enough room for dissenting voices?
Well, there's plenty of room. There's just not enough people are willing to take the risk.
Jim, I don't know whether we've confirmed that this was an air crash, or to be more specific, some people said they saw a missile.
There was definitely a blue logo. It was like a circular logo on the front of the plane. It definitely did not look like a commercial plane. I didn't see any windows on the sides.
Mark, if what you say is true, those could be cargo planes. You said you didn't see any windows in the side?
I didn't see any windows on the side. It was not a normal flight that I've ever seen at an airport. It was a plane that had a blue logo on the front, and it did not look like it belonged in this area.
It's just sort of a herd mentality, a lemming-like mentality. If you don't go with the flow, you're anti-American, and therefore a suspect.
This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
Sort of wonder when something like that happens, well, who stands to benefit? You know, who has the opportunity and motive? You just gotta look at these basic things. I don't assume that I know the truth about what went on that day. And yeah, I just look around and looking for, well, who had the motive, who had the opportunity, who had the equipment, who had the will. The White House and campaigns, and I've known enough of the people who do these things to know that the public version of the news, whatever it's been, is never really going to happen. And these people, I think, are willing to take that even further.
It seems a very long bow to me, but are you sort of suggesting that this worked in the favor of the Bush administration?
Oh, absolutely.
938, Arlington, Virginia. Hani Hanyor allegedly executes a 330-degree turn at 530 miles per hour. Descending 7,000 feet in 2.5 minutes to crash American Airlines Flight 77 into the ground floor of the Pentagon. Final approach took it directly across Washington Boulevard. Knocking light poles out of the ground and bouncing off of the lawn before impact. First, let's meet Hani Hanyor. Hanyor had come to Freeway Airport in Bowie, Maryland 1 month earlier seeking to rent a small plane. However, when Hanyor went on 3 test runs in the second week of August, he had trouble controlling and landing a single-engine Cessna 172.
Well, my name is Marcel Bernard, and I'm the chief flight instructor here at Freeway. Hani Hanyor, well, basically what happened with him is he showed up at the airport and wanted to get checked out in the aircraft. See, he was already certified. He didn't come to us for flight training.
Yeah, he already had a pilot's license.
He had already earned his private instrument commercial at a school in Arizona. I don't remember the name of the school, but already had certificates in hand. And we sometimes occasionally have pilots that come to us that don't want flight training but just want to rent our aircraft.
Which is the case of Hani Hanyor.
This is the case of Hani. He wanted to get checked out, as we call it, to rent our aircraft. And our insurance requires that he flies with one of our instructors to be found competent to rent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the process that he was going through. The census was that he was very quiet, average or below average piloting skills.
Mm-hmm.
English was very poor. So I don't know where to. That's about the best description I can get give you for his demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
At that time. Very, you know, uneventful from our perspective.
Regardless, air traffic controllers at Dulles International Airport that were tracking Flight 77 all thought that it was a military plane. Second, the light poles. On November 22, 2004, a private jet en route to Houston to pick up George Bush Sr. clipped a single light pole and crashed a minute away from landing at Houston's Hobby Airport. The wing ripped off upon impact, scattering debris over 100 yards. And yet, Flight 77 managed to tear 5 light poles completely out of the ground, maintaining enough control and energy to crash into the ground floor of the Pentagon. Third, you only have to look at the photos from that day to realize that whatever hit the Pentagon did not bounce off the lawn. If Flight 77 had crash-landed and skidded into the Pentagon, it would have looked something like this. Instead, it looked like this, without a single scratch on the lawn. Fourth, why is there no discernible trace of Flight 77?
You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual site of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon.
The official explanation is that the intense heat from the jet fuel vaporized the entire plane. Indeed, from these pictures, it seems that there's absolutely no trace of a fully loaded Boeing 757. But if the fire was hot enough to incinerate a jumbo jet, then how could investigators identify 184 out of 189 people found at the Pentagon? The Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, which was responsible for the task, was also responsible for identifying the dead in Shanksville. Keep that in mind for later. So what is a Boeing 757 made of? The exact details are not public knowledge. But what we do know is that Flight 77 had 2 Rolls-Royce RB211 engines made of steel and titanium alloy,
which are 9 feet in diameter, 12 feet long, and weigh 6 tons each. Titanium has a melting point of 1,688 degrees Celsius. Jet fuel is a hydrocarbon, which can maintain a constant temperature of 1,120 degrees Celsius after 40 minutes, but only if the fuel source is maintained. The fuel would have burned off immediately upon impact. Therefore, it is scientifically impossible that 12 tons of steel and titanium was vaporized by jet fuel. Likewise, the two engines should have been found relatively intact at the Pentagon. Instead, there was a single turbojet engine, approximately 3 feet in diameter, found inside the building. After this photo was published by American Free Press, readers wrote in to suggest that the turbine was a piece from the Auxiliary Power Unit, APU, located in the tail section of a 757. Chris Bolin contacted Honeywell in Phoenix, Arizona, the manufacturer of the 757's APU. An expert, speaking on the condition of anonymity, told Bolin that there's no way that's an APU wheel. Bolin then contacted Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce, the two companies that manufacture 757 engines. Pratt & Whitney pointed Bolin towards Rolls-Royce, and John W. Brown, a spokesman for Rolls-Royce, told Bolin that it is not a part from any Rolls-Royce engine that I'm familiar with. So, if this piece didn't come from a 757, then where? And where are the two engines from Flight 77? The second identifiable piece of debris was allegedly a piece of the fuselage. Skeptics have claimed that this is proof that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. But this piece could have come from any American Airlines plane, and why is it not singed or scratched after a 530-mile-per-hour impact and the subsequent fireball? The third piece of debris was allegedly a diffuser case. Let's look a little closer at the diffuser case of a 757. Do you see the triangular bezels around the openings? Those are nowhere to be found on the case found at the Pentagon. The remainder of the debris was light enough to have been carried by hand. If Flight 77 vaporized on impact, it would be the first time in aviation history. For example, August 15, 2005, Helios Airways Flight 522, a Boeing 737, en route to Athens, Greece, crashed into a hillside at full speed. 121 passengers, all dead. Fire. Tail sections. Wing sections. Engines. Cockpit. Bodies. Catch my drift? Fifth, why is the damage to the Pentagon completely inconsistent with a Boeing 757? These photos were taken before the roof of the outer ring had collapsed. The only visible damage to the outer wall is a single hole, no more than 16 feet in diameter. A Boeing 757 is 155 feet long, 44 feet high, has a 124-foot wingspan, and weighs almost 100 tons. Are we supposed to believe that it disappeared into this hole without leaving any wreckage on the outside? Why is there no damage from where the wings, or the vertical stabilizer, or the engines would have slammed into the building? Remember how big the engines were? If 6 tons of steel and titanium slammed into the Pentagon at 530 miles per hour, they would bury themselves inside the building, leaving 2 very distinct imprints. And yet, the only damage to the outer wall is this single hole, with no damage from where the engines would have hit. Why are the windows next to the hole completely intact? Why are the cable spools in front of the hole unmoved? As for the inside of the Pentagon, there's another hole, approximately 16 feet in diameter, found on the other side of the C-ring, 3 rings from the impact. For that hole to have been caused by Flight 77, the Boeing would have had to smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete, traveling 310 feet. The nose of a commercial airliner is composed of lightweight carbon. This is what usually happens to the nose of a commercial airliner in a plane crash. If the nose caused this hole, where's the rest of the debris from the plane? So, what could blow a 16-foot hole on the outer ring of the Pentagon, smash through 3 rings, 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete, and leave another 16-foot hole? A 757? Or a cruise missile? This is what Slobodan Milosevic's house in Belgrade looked like after a Tomahawk cruise missile had hit it. See any similarities?
I was heading in northbound Six. On 27.
The eyewitnesses.
The traffic this morning, it was, you know, typical.
Some saw
rush
a
hour.
Huge 100-ton commercial airliner.
And I looked off. I was, you know, looked out my window. I saw this plane, a jet, American Airlines jet, coming.
Some saw a small 8-to-20 passenger commuter plane.
So it looked to be maybe a 20-passenger corporate jet, no markings on the side, coming in at a shallow.
And some saw a United States military helicopter.
When it occurred, he said that he saw a helicopter circle the building. He said that it appeared to be a U.S. military helicopter, and that it disappeared behind the building where the helicopter landing zone is, and that he then saw a fireball go into the sky.
So, if a Boeing 757 didn't hit the Pentagon, then what did? Eyewitnesses inside and outside the building were thrown to the ground by what they described as a shockwave. Even the Sheraton Hotel, 1.6 miles away, was rocked by the blast. A number of military personnel at the Pentagon specifically mentioned smelling cordite. Cordite and jet fuel have two very distinct smells. Cordite is a compound used in ammunition, which is comprised of nitroguanidine, nitrocellulose, and nitroglycerin. It is cool burning, produces little smoke and no flash, but produces a strong detonation wave. And eyewitnesses described a bright, silvery flash. Jet fuel combustion, i.e., the planes that hit the Twin Towers, is bright yellow at best. Watch this. A massive, smoldering fireball. No silvery flash. No shockwave. And at the Pentagon, a tiny, bright, silvery flash, which shakes nearby buildings. So what hit the Pentagon? Whatever it was, it might be related to the two planes that were in the air after the crash. The first one was uniformly identified as a C-130. The second plane was an unmarked white plane flying over Washington, D.C.
Aaron, I'm standing in Lafayette Park directly across from the White House, perhaps about 200 yards from the White House residence itself. About 10 minutes ago, there was a white jet circling overhead. Now, you generally don't see planes in the area over the White House. That is restricted airspace. No reason to believe that this jet was there for any nefarious purposes, but the Secret Service was very concerned, pointing up at the jet in the sky. It is out of sight now.
At 9:25, Jane Garvey, the head of the FAA, initiated a national ground stop, which prevents further takeoffs and requires all planes in the air to land. The order, which hasn't been implemented since the beginning of aviation, applied to almost every kind of plane. Civilian, military, or law enforcement. Certain military flights were allowed to fly during this time, but the FAA isn't talking. Why were these two planes allowed in the air when everyone else had to land? And finally, why did people keep reporting a series of second explosions at the Pentagon?
Well, I can't tell you about that, but I was just here in front of the Capitol, which, by the way, has been evacuated. And back toward the Supreme Court area, we just heard a low, muffled thud. It sounded like a small explosion.
There have been unconfirmed reports of second explosions here at the Pentagon. We have not confirmed that, but again, the counter...
7. Surveillance cameras from a nearby gas station, Sheraton Hotel, and the Virginia Department of Transportation would have captured the entire thing. However, The FBI was there within minutes to confiscate the tapes, including a warning for the employees not to discuss what they had seen. If the government wishes to prove to us, once and for all, that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, all they have to do is release video footage of Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon. Instead, they've released 5 frames from a camera across the heliport, even though none of them clearly show a Boeing 757. Is it merely coincidence that the Pentagon was hit in the only section that was renovated to withstand that very same kind of attack? And that Donald Rumsfeld was safe in his office on the opposite end of the building? If the government has nothing to hide, why are they so afraid to answer a few questions or release a few videos? '59, New York City, New York. The South Tower of the World Trade Center collapses to the ground in approximately 10 seconds. 29 minutes later, the North Tower follows suit, collapsing in approximately 10 seconds. Later that evening at 5:20, World Trade Center 7, a 47-story office building 300 feet away from the North Tower, suddenly collapses. The building's tenants included the CIA, Department of Defense, IRS, Secret Service, and Rudy Giuliani's emergency bunker. And the SEC was using it to store 3,000 to 4,000 files related to numerous Wall Street investigations. Although every single building surrounding Building 7 and the Twin Towers remained standing, Building 7 fell straight down into a convenient little pile in 6 seconds. Official explanation? Falling debris from the Twin Towers created an internal fire which ignited several fuel tanks inside the building. If this is true, then it would be the third steel-framed building in history to collapse because of a fire. The first two would be the Twin Towers. On July 28, 1945, a B-25 bomber, lost in the fog, crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building. 14 people dead, $1 million in damage, but the building stands intact to this day. On February 14, 1975, a 3-alarm fire broke out between the 9th and 14th floors of the North Tower. According to the New York Times, the fire leads to intense scrutiny of the towers, and eventually to a decision to install sprinklers. On May 4, 1988, a 62-story skyscraper in Los Angeles burned for 3 hours and spread over 4 floors. It did not collapse. On February 23, 1991, a 38-story skyscraper in Philadelphia, built in 1973, burned for more than 19 hours and spread over 8 floors. It did not collapse. On October 17, 2004, a 56-story skyscraper in Venezuela, built in 1976, burned for over 17 hours and spread to over 26 floors, eventually reaching the roof. Guess what? It did not collapse. On February 12, 2005, the Windsor Building in Madrid, a 32-story tower framed in steel-reinforced concrete, burned for almost 24 hours, completely eradicating the upper 10 stories of the building. Although the top 10 floors of the building fell, the building itself did not collapse. And yet, on September 11, 2001, two 110-story skyscrapers, completed in 1973, burned for 56 and 103 minutes, respectively, over 4 floors, before collapsing completely to the ground. One might argue that this was due to the construction of the World Trade Center. The Twin Towers were composed of 200,000 tons of steel. 425,000 cubic yards of concrete, 103 elevators, 43,600 windows, 60,000 tons of cooling equipment, and a 360-foot television antenna. The core of each tower was 87 by 133 feet, comprised of 47 box columns 36 by 16 inches thick, the North Tower, was completed in 1970, standing at 1,368 feet tall, and the South Tower was completed in 1973, clocking in at 1,362 feet tall, making them the tallest buildings in the world until the Sears Tower was completed in 1974. And to think, the federal government would have us believe that these massive structures were destroyed by 10,000 gallons of jet fuel. However, eyewitnesses, video footage, and a little common sense quickly refutes that claim. The second plane hits the South Tower between the 78th and 82nd floors at 9:03 a.m. Slicing through the southeast corner, the majority of the jet fuel exploding outside in a massive fireball. Yet, this tower collapses first, even though the North Tower was hit straight on and had already been burning for 18 minutes longer. Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion determine how quickly an object will travel a certain distance in complete freefall. Time squared equals distance squared divided by acceleration due to gravity. The South Tower was 1,362 feet tall. 85.1 equals 2724 divided by 32, or 9.2 seconds. The Twin Towers came down in nearly free fall speed. 200,000 tons of steel shatters and explodes outwards over 500 feet. 425,000 cubic yards of concrete is pulverized into dust. Thousands of lives are extinguished instantly. So what brought down the World Trade Center? Let's ask the experts. Van Romero, Vice President for Research at New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. My opinion is, based on the videotapes, after the airplanes hit the World Trade Center, there were some explosive devices inside the building that caused the towers to collapse. 10 days later. Certainly the fire is what caused the building to fail. Why would Romero change his mind so suddenly? Hyman Brown, Civil Engineering Professor and the World Trade Center's Construction Manager. It was overdesigned to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, high winds, bombings, and an airplane hitting it. Although the buildings were designed to withstand a 150-year storm and the impact of a Boeing 707, jet fuel burning at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit weakened the steel. Kevin Ryan, Underwriters Laboratories, in a letter to Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We know that the steel components were certified to ASTM E119. The time temperature curves for this standard require the samples to be exposed to temperatures around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for several hours, and as we all agree, the steel applied met those specifications. Additionally, I think we can all agree that even unfireproof steel will not melt until reaching red-hot temperatures of nearly 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Why Dr. Brown would imply that 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit would melt the high-grade steel used in those buildings makes no sense at all. This story just does not add up. If steel from those buildings did soften or melt, I'm sure we can all agree that this was certainly not due to jet fuel fires of any kind, let alone the briefly burning fires in those towers. Ryan's statements directly contradict statements from other experts claiming that 2,000-degree heat inside the World Trade Center caused the towers to collapse. As such, days after writing this letter, Kevin Ryan was fired from his position. Not even the experts agree with each other. So what else could have caused the Twin Towers and Building 7 to collapse?
10 o'clock Eastern Time this morning, just collapsing on itself.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed.
We have no idea what caused this.
Almost looks like one of those planned implosions.
As if a demolition team set off when you see the old demolitions of these old buildings. It pulled it down on itself and it is not there anymore.
If you wish to bring anybody who's ever watched a building being demolished on purpose knows that if you're going to do this, you have to get at the under infrastructure of a building and bring it down.
We heard another explosion, and I'm assuming that's the one that came from the lower level. Since there were two, and I said,
right, because it was like 18 minutes apart.
Well, this is the first explosion, and there was a second explosion in the same building. There were two explosions.
Okay.
Federal agencies that were down there do believe that there was some sort of explosive device somewhere else besides the planes hitting.
NBC's Pat Dawson is close to the scene of that attack. Pat.
Just moments ago, I spoke to the chief of safety for the New York City Fire Department, Chief Albert Turry. He received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place. And then an hour after the first hit here, or the first crash that took place, he said, there was another explosion that took place in one of the towers here. He thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. The second device, he thinks, he speculates, was probably planted in the building.
There were two or three similar huge explosions, and the building literally shook. You literally shook at the base of this building.
First one and then the other, some say after secondary explosions.
But a big explosion happened, all of a sudden the elevator blew up, smoke. I dragged the guy out, his skin was hanging off, and I dragged him out, and I helped him out of the ambulance.
Walking down the stairs, we made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion.